So let's start off. A few questions in order to just kind of kick off the thought processes in respect to multiple inheritance. So the first one, how can you quickly tell for a language with multiple inheritance whether there is linearization applied or not? That's kind of not a really decisive thing, but it's kind of a, just a clue on whether there is linearization or not. What do you think of the fact that with the,
make two classes who implement the same method and then make a third class inheriting from both of them, and I don't know if you have to overwrite this method or if you just can call it and then see if it throws an error or not.
That's kind of the way when you produce code, you could kind of have a test routine for setting up a situation which would just conflict in a case where there's no linearization, and that would be automatically resolved in case there is linearization. However, there would have also been this just a plain syntax thing. There's this super keyword, remember? What's that? Not. Oh, the touch is still enabled. Well, that is really nice. That's not so good for writing on. So if you have super keyword in your language, then it means that there is kind of a unique predecessor in terms of inheritance. At least it was so for a long time. I don't know how well you are updated, for example, with the Java changes in the last few releases. They had this feature of interface methods being implementable. And in connection with that, there's kind of a reusage of the super keyword in order to do a kind of an explicit qualification thing, which is weird by itself a little bit. But yeah, so the pure existence of such a super keyword in principle would mean that there is a conceptual linearization or just one parent involved. However, yeah, practical implementations, as I've told you about, that makes matters a lot more complicated. Yeah, but the kind of decisive thing would actually be to kind of set up such a conflicting situation, as you mentioned. That would be with a little bit of more work, of course, because you have to create the classes, but it's kind of the decisive way of telling whether there is linearization or not. Okay, next one. How does the number of objects relate to the number of virtual tables? That should give you a little bit of a feeling of how during the runtime memory is actually organized. I think I mentioned it somewhere in the slides, but yeah.
Well, I think it doesn't. It only depends on the number of classes.
It relates. Or there's no relation between those exactly. Mm-hmm. And so you have a split representation of an object in memory, in the sense that the part that represents its data is the one that's replicated for, well, it's not replicated, but it gets a new representation each time an object is created, since you have a per object evaluation of an attribute. And the virtual table part is something that is related to the actual structure of all the objects that are of one common type. So there needs only be one instance of the virtual table in memory. And the connection between those is with this pointer structure, with this vtable pointers. So they evaluate to the exact same pointer values throughout all the objects of one class, but you need that connection in order to relate them to a certain virtual table. So virtual tables, once in memory per class, object representations, multiples for each of the objects. When is the virtual table computed? Well, I think that needs a little bit of elaboration on what computed means, but when I asked myself that question, that was about the actual layout of the virtual table. When is that planned or laid out? And usually in compilers, you do work as early as possible, in the sense that everything that comes later on might be repeated several times, so you might not want to do computations back then. And yeah, when would be the time to compute virtual tables? Runtime or compile time? Yeah, because I was a little bit skeptical with this word computed. There's also a runtime aspect in the sense that you have to lay it out in memory, of course, and you have to load it from disk into memory, and then only you have the concrete addresses. There might be techniques where you have this boot image stored in the binary, which is just transferred once, so you have kind of constant offsets to the beginning of the thing. But yeah, that is that is the situation. So you have pre-computed layout of the whole thing. And on the other side, there's this setup in memory, which is in the runtime. So compile time, runtime, in that sense. So is every class associated with a unique virtual table? I think the second part of the question with what about virtual subtables already gives you a clue that it's not one unique table, but it's more of a composed thing. So you don't have the virtual table, except if you look at the complete composition of all the virtual subtables, then that might be the unique virtual table for an object. Yeah, I think that says it all already. So the next one. Now is a little bit more concrete with things that you can actually derive from source code. A little bit of time to just scan what is presented here. So we have a class structure. We have classes D and E, which are kind of leaves in this inheritance tree, or in this case graph, as we have multiple inheritance. There's an object A, which inherits from B and C. B inherits from D. C inherits from E in a virtual way. So maybe let's create some kind of a graph for that. So there's A, then there's B and C, and A inherits from B and C. I always get the arrows wrong. Is it that way? Okay, thank you. B and D, like that, and C goes to E. Assuming the existence of implementations for each instance of F, so each of these methods is not only declared, but it's also defined later on as a concrete implementation. Which of the following calls involves a virtual thunk? Oh, well, it goes right into the details. So, yeah. Any idea? Or maybe let's just try to disassemble all the ones and check whether one of them actually has something to do with virtual thunks. Oh, how nice. I see right now that there's a little bit of pointer confusion in that. Oh, yeah. That will work for sure, won't it? Yeah. Mm. Okay. That's something I have to patch in the things, but... Yeah, you would assume that you would need something like an address of operator somewhere. So, yeah. Apart from the things not compiling, maybe let's ignore that for now and assume that there's this address of operator there. Then we have an object A. And a pointer to E that's created from that. And then we call A's method F with pointer to E as parameter. So is there any virtual thunk in there? Well, there's several kind of things that give you clues whether there is a thunk at all involved in all of that. And the things thunks are only then something that that is used if this pointer at some point had been casted to something. So, for that one here, it had been casted, but it's not the casted version that is used to perform the actual call. So, without knowing the implementation of F, of course, at least the part that we see here doesn't have any virtual thunk in there, or any thunk at all. Next one, once again A, and once again, same mistake. I might need to check my compiler, but the thing would be we would like to cast to the E part of the E, of the representation. Then we have now, as a difference to before, we now use the E as the original, as the receiver of the call, or as this pointer, and here we give it a address of A as parameter, which is also an E, of course. While here we perform a call on a receiver that has been casted. So, somehow readjusting the pointer to the actual overwritten version should be performed. So there is actually a func in there. Now the question is whether that is a virtual one or a non-virtual one. Maybe let's do a few other quick checks whether there are other func situations in there. So that one was none. This one over here, once again, has an A. So this one is probably also not one, but the others all have casted receivers. So the next thing that needs to be addressed is, well, we were probably a little bit fast with marking that as a thunk. Thunk are only necessary when there has been actual transformation of the evaluation of the pointer underneath. So that's only when there is actually something with multiple inheritance going on in there. For our purposes, everything that is B and C and so on is, of course, multiple inheritance related. So that's a plus. Then, to be more specific, it's not all the ancestors that make pointer transformation necessary. That depends on the actual layout of your composed class. So what you need to look out for is the middle part of the object, where the kind of the second parent is inserted. So remember, when we lay out these classes, we have the child class at the bottom and the two parents above, and the parent which is directly in front of the child, but coming directly after the first parent, that is the one which needs to be cast into. So yeah, if we have a look at these expressions, of course that was a kind of an arbitrary decision to have the second of the parents actually be the one to put into the middle, but that is kind of a compiler convention. So that's how we introduce the whole thing. So in this case, we would assume that we remain with the same principles that we had, and this would mean it's only the casts to something C related that are actually manipulating this pointer. So casting to B doesn't do any manipulations. And with that longish prologue, that one's also not a thunk, because that casts to B, and that is right in front and doesn't perform any transformation on this pointer. Okay, good. Then we have only two candidates left for thunks, E and C. Both of them stem from the part over here, which is in the kind of exposed middle position in the layout. So both of them have chunks. The question is now which of them has the virtual thunk and which of them has the static thunk, as both of of course I did both of them in there. And that just has to do with whether you do static addition to the this pointer, or subtraction depending on your address layout. And that is the one that is directly inherited. So that would be the C part. So this one also has a thunk. But that is the conventional thunk, the ordinary one that we have seen with the addition of the constant. This is adding kind of the size of B class to the pointer. Then we have the E one, which is the virtual inherited one, which could be found anywhere in memory. So we don't have a constant offset anymore to this E. That is due to the virtual keyword over here. So for this one, we find that we have to look up this the displacements in the virtual table, which means that that is the virtual func. And with that, we get our answer. Yeah, pretty much, well, it's a lot of work to do for just one cross. But, yeah, I think it's nice to see what the actual clues to look out for are in these situations. So if ever you need to create an actual example to test how these virtual thunks work, you need to create a situation where you have multiple inheritance, especially, or, well, I think it's the multiple inheritance one is only the one for the ordinary thunk. The virtual inheritance would create such a thing anyway, although it might not do an actual addition in case that there's no multiple inheritance. It might be optimized away in a later stage when you optimize more aggressively, but that's a little bit down into the fields of how compilers work. So now about layout of representations in memory. Yeah. To peek into that myself. But anyway, complete the object representation and virtual table diagrams for the following. So we have a class A, class D, and a class V. Class D inherits from A and inherits from V. However, the V is a virtual one. Okay. So what you see already planned out here is that A goes at the top, and D is somewhere don't know where it is. There's space before and after D for placing V into. So where does V go to?
Below D, because of the virtual relation.
So we have a VAT over here. In principle, there's no reason for it to be at the bottom. It was our convention. In principle, it could be somewhere in memory. It somehow needs to have a constant offset to the not a constant offset, but a known offset to the beginning, which I can put into my virtual table. However, for our purposes, it is just at the bottom of the object representation. Am I done now? Well, maybe this one also goes with the D, with the V, so I will just fill that in. less kind of suspicious space over here. Yeah, so we need to make sure that everything else in terms of memory layout is kind of correct. So we should maybe make sure that the sub-virtual tables are somehow related to their counterparts in the object representations. So at that point, I was a little bit too fast with my layout here, because virtual tables always start at the front, so maybe there is need for a virtual table pointer here. Who knows? First of all, D also doesn't have a virtual table pointer in this diagram right now. Do I need to add one? Not so sure. The question is quite related to this inheritance style that we have here between A and D. And I think that is kind of the conventional inheritance thing. And it also applies even in the multiple inheritance case, at least to the first parent of such a multiple inheritance relation. And these first things, or the ordinary inheritance, is always a special case in the sense that I can still somehow apply this concept of the child extending the parent. We said for those things it would be quite easy to set up the memory layout, because I just have to plug them one after each other in a sequence. And I can even benefit from my knowledge that it's only growing by the extensions and reusing everything in front. Especially what I can reuse is the V-table pointer, because we have seen that for these non-multiple inheritances and the first parents, the layout of the virtual table is also kind of modular, in the sense that I can just extend it by introducing new slots at the end, which don't intersect with the part of the function pointers from the parent intersects then with the part of the child's function pointers, but the ones that are the extensions are coming at the bottom, so they don't interfere with the entries that are only valid for the parent. So I can kind of share that space also. So in that sense, it's not needed to create a separate virtual table pointer. And it's even a nonsensical thing to insert, because of the fact that the only way that the compilation scheme addresses the virtual table pointer is always through looking at the first slot in memory where your this or receiver pointer points to, actually. So even if you introduced V pointer in there, which would have to point to the same thing because it reuses that, you could kind of create a clone of that and extend it by the things that you need to have, but why should you do that? It's just creating memory overhead. And that thing is never accessed, because there's just no pointer computation between A and D. So always, when you refer to your object D, you will always refer to the pointer that goes to the beginning here, and not to something that goes in here. That's not done. Okay, so, long story short, we don't need a VTable pointer for the D part. It's even nonsensical to have something like that, because there's no address computation ever reaching that thing. However, we might be interested in, at some point, addressing the attribute V here. So, in case that I have my object code for D, and I want to address that thing, we said that this offset here would be non-constant value. We can't be sure at compile time what to expect to have as a distance from top of the object. So what I need is this value, delta V, being managed in here as a pointer to the virtual base. That is one of the components that we had in the lecture slides somewhere in the end, I think. Remember? Yeah. That part over here where you have this virtual table for a virtual subclass, which is this one over here. So, part over here. And it gives us the difference in terms of addresses from the start of the object representation to the start of the W subpart.
We can see that.
We can see that,
no,
yeah.
We can't. Physically.
Oh. I thought it would only affect the viewers at home. So now, at least we can see it.
Yeah.
Pretty much all. Almost. So, yeah. The delta V from above, that is the one that gives us a way to compute the start address of the base class. So it's not an absolute address that's in there, because remember, virtual tables exist for all the classes out there, and I can't put a constant address in there because we have several instances, but I can put offsets in there. And that's what I also need to fill in here. Good. That's quite nice so far. However, we have seen already in the exercise before that there's a concept of something like the virtual thunk that is always a topic in the situation of multiple inheritance, especially with virtual parents. And for that, yeah, we need special trampoline functions called thunks to readjust the pointer to the receiver for that. In order to be called at all, we need to keep them, keep book of them within the representation, not the representation, within the virtual table somehow. Especially what we do is we would always want to have them called before we actually call into the concrete implementation of the method. So instead of calling these implementation of F directly, we would want to go through in the call graph through the thunk before. In order to do so, we need a different virtual table, not the standard one that is applicable for the D objects. So we create a subtable here. So that is the one over here. We would keep a separate thing here. This is the RTTI, which is not so interesting for us. But what we would introduce is a vpointer over here, and it would point into some place in the virtual table, which would then be the one that holds whatever should be executed for in case that I want to call virtual method F. And in our case, it would be a version that is called whenever I come from, well, that's my way of marking that is the thunk that is due to class V in here. Whenever you find a representation from your compiler, it might even write plain text, here is the virtual thunk for method that. For me, if I find something like that in an exam solution from your side, as long as you get the concept right that here is a virtual thunk and it has to do with method F from V, I'm not caring about the actual concrete syntax that you use to designate that thing. It's just a kind of an aid from my side that's how I denote them. But for me, it would be sufficient to say in that slot is the thunk, and if it's a virtual thunk, then of course virtual thunk. But yeah, just a side note. And so with that, we are almost done. Now the question is, we always had a little bit of fiddling of what to put up here. There's also entries for that, and one part of that was to do with the finding the back to the surrounding objects representation, because remember we have this non-constant offset to the beginning of the object representation. So whenever we enter the virtual table from this subpart of the object's representation, we also need to somehow get a handle back to the start of the object. And that's what is done with the entry directly above this RTTI space. And that just gives you a way back to the start. And then what we need to put in is this virtual call offset. This is again helping to manipulate the receiver pointer to re-establish the right start of the object for that particular overwritten version of the method. So we need to have the delta V in there. That was the offset to top. That is there for general purpose navigation to the top. And then the next slot up there is reserved. There's a slot for each of the entries of function pointers in the virtual table here. And since we have one entry in the function table here, we also need one entry in the area over here. And that is now, that now has to do with the virtual thunk, with its partnering virtual thunk. The relation is established by the index. And the virtual thunk here needs to readjust this pointer not only to the start of the object, but instead, depending on the actual need of adjustment that is expected by the actual implementation of the method. So if F is overwritten in some strangely enclosed inner class. It would expect the object pointed to not point to the beginning but to somewhere there, for example. It's not happening here, but there might be situations where you have your implementations done by some parent class, somehow inherited as a second parent somewhere in your hierarchy. And if you have something like that, then you don't need your delta V, like the one that I put in there, but you would need the delta V minus the actual delta of what you actually want to reach. But for our purposes, it's just delta V. I think in the lectures virtual table, there is all sorts of implementations of methods flying around here, and some of them need adaptations of these pointers. So that's already kind of indicated here, but for our example, it doesn't play a role. It's still delta V. Whew. Okay. With that, we're done with completing that thing. Good. Is the cast correct? Yeah, that should be a shorter one. We have A acting as a virtual base class for B and C, and D inheriting from B and C. So the usual diamond in inheritance patterns. We create a C, not a D, okay, nice. Then we cast it to A, and then cast it back to C. Does that work? Probably if I ask such a question, then it's usually no. It probably matters more why it's not correct. I think that was also more or less a side note in the slides. If you think back to the slide with the cast to and from the virtual parent, and yeah, it's just the, kind of a dumb reason, so to say. In the development of the object-oriented system here, I think they took the same approach as the C part when implementing that, these kinds of casts. And that would mean that they would perform a simple pointer adjustment in terms of additions and subtractions of only constants whenever you have these static casts, how they are called. It matters quite a lot whether you have a constant added here or not, because if you don't add a constant, you somehow have to compute whatever value you have to add on there. So it's not only an addition necessary, but also some kind of navigation through the virtual table pointers and all that to somehow reach the point in memory where you can read the actual value with which you want to adjust your pointer. So that's what the plain cast here just doesn't do. So for those purposes, you the compiler can't find any constant to add to your pointer, so it will not compile that. Instead, you have seen the solution already on there, or even not. Maybe not even. There's this idea of dynamic casts that actually perform the lookup of your virtual base pointer through the virtual table pointer, and then, or the virtual base offset, it's not a pointer, virtual base offset it is, and read that from the virtual table and put that in. Whew. Done with that. Yeah, well, I don't know if you feel punished already right now. Serve yourself with a little bit of sugar and brain food. If not, we can dive right into concrete exercise with linearization. Next, where we just kind of try to apply the things that we have heard in the lecture in a concrete example. Maybe give me a short break for figuring out how to deal with the mouse events of my fingers. Figured it out. Okay. So these are the basic components of the class structure here. So maybe the first idea would be to just put the classes into a diagram or a graph. So we have this D and yeah, the D is the one for G. Nice. D like this. E is the one for F. Then we have C, which is on FG. So goes to F and G. Also it has this weird multiplicity thing going on. Then there's B. which goes to D and E, creating a multiplicity like this. And then there is an A that has B and C, also creating multiplicity, which is now really confusing.
I didn't lay it out here as a thing, so that is kind of a best thing that I can do impromptu. So, with that now, we are supposed to do an LPDFS with duplicate cancellation. Yeah, first of all, what is LPDFS? Leftmost. The P was really a good idea to use because it's either post order or pre order. So. Very nice. Okay. In that case, it's meant to be pre order, but. Yeah, that's not clearly obvious from just the abbreviation. Anyway, with duplicate cancellation. Good, so this is the first part. Yeah?
Yeah, well, we start off at A.
A is the first one.
Then we go to B.
A, B.
From there to D.
D. That's why I do these weird curved ones here. To make sure that you get the right idea. Yeah. A, B, G. D. G.
Now we go back to... to B.
Exactly.
And from there on we go to B. To E.
To E, yes.
And then we go to F.
Yes. I think there's no other than A now, but we go back.
Right, then from A we go to C.
Go to C.
Then to F.
Then to F.
And finally reach G. And now we just scratch the first G and the first F. Mm-hmm. Yeah, now we finish.
A, B, D, E, C, F, G. I think that should be doable, shouldn't it? Okay, good. Next one. Reverse post order rightmost DFS.
So we go down to G, which will be the first to be emitted. To be emitted. So, yeah, A, B, D, G.
Mm-hmm.
No, A, C, G.
A, C, G, yeah.
Then upwards to C, post order, and then F.
Yeah, with post order I don't put out C now. I do
F and then C. And then downward to E because F is emitted yet.
Mm-hmm.
Then D, same reason, G is emitted before, so D.
Yeah, that's right, yeah.
Upwards to B and last would be A. And then the reverse.
Mm-hmm. So we read A, B, D, E, C, F, G, which is exactly the line before.
So, yeah, we would have to reverse. And that will give us A, B, D, E, C, F, G. And if I would have put the things more intelligently, I would have already put them down in the right sequence. Good. So far, so nice. Now, let's have a look at the third one, which is the C3 linearization. For that, it just doesn't matter what that all is about. The eraser is pretty similar to one for pencils. I have to scratch a lot. Good. So, for that, we just start with the leaf ones. So F and G, we have seen, are the L of F, sorry. L of G. We have seen that these are the leaves in our, or the ones without any output, outgoing nodes. So for these, we have just F and G as their linearizations. It's not too difficult then. Then the next would be ones that are just building upon the basics, and well, F and G are here and here, so these are completed. Actually, also this one is completed, but we can choose which one we do next. So let's do maybe D and E. And that's simple. First of all, you put the class itself there, and then the merge of all the parents. Easy, once again, F. Is it? Sorry, D. Aha, it's not so easy. It's G. I would benefit from being able to read. This one is E and has F, like that. So not too difficult. So the first real difficulty lies in the C. By the way, we have now computed D and E, so this is also given. So let's try C, maybe. And that is now a little bit to do. There's C, then we get to the point of merging, and we merge C's parents. That's F and G. F and G both are singular lists, F, G, and then we come to the list F times G. Like that. Cool. So that is C, and start from the front. F is our first candidate, doesn't occur in G. Does occur in F and G, but is the head there, so is fine. So we have C times F, and we can continue with that. Yeah, and there's only one remaining, so we get C of G. Also not so difficult. Now, the next layer of difficulty lies in B. B is built from B times the merge of D and E. D is D times G, and E is E, well, it's not times, it's concatenated, EF. And then we have the parents, and these parents are D and E, so we do it like that. D and E. So with that we get B, of course. Next one, D. Is D a good choice?
D is a good choice. So we can cancel this one and this one. Next candidate is which one? E or G?
G?
Yeah, always begin at the start of things. So, G, is it a good candidate?
Yes.
And doesn't occur. Next one, I think there's not much debate here. E, is E a good candidate? It's also good, it's only occurring at the top here, so we have E and F. Good. That'd be nice. So, the last of ours, linearization of A yields A concatenated with A. Well, what's now to concatenate? We have the list for B. That is B, D, G, E, F. We have C, which is C, F, G, and we have B, C. Okay, let's remove this part to have more space to actually work on that. So, luckily, it's only very little number of lists to join. So, first candidate, B, of course. B is not occurring here, but occurring here as a head. So, fine with that. D doesn't occur anyone else. G well it's here, so that's not a good candidate. Next one, C probably only occurs over here, so we can cross it out and put it in here. Next iteration, G, still bad. What can I do? F. Let's choose F. Yeah, bummer. So, here we can't continue and have fail due to G and F. Good. Or bad for the programmer here, but for us it's good. So, is there questions on how to perform that? I think it should be quite straightforward. We don't even have to recurse our evaluations, so that should be just doable. Good. So, back here, we have multiple inheritance straight from the exam 2015. Provide a C++ class structure and a main function which fails to compile due to multiple inheritance causing, for once, an ambiguously resolvable call expression, and for second, an ambiguous casting target types. Yeah. Ambiguously resolvable call expression. That was already quite in the basics, I would say. I hope you
remember what we meant with that. So we need to have inheritance structure where we could resolve call to a function either through one parent or the other. That would be the ambiguously resolvable call expression. So we need that situation of having two parents, A and C, and a common child, and F being part of both of them, and yeah. So that is the whole thing translated, kind of. I guess you know how to program something like that. Okay, then the ambiguous casting target types. Yeah. Whenever, when do you imagine a cast to be ambiguous? Well, the kind of the cast target needs to be in your class hierarchy several times for that, in order for a cast from your child to some parent to be ambiguous. So for that, you need something like a child inheriting from two parents, mother and father, and both of them inheriting from some ancestor that both of them have in common. If you create something like that, you have... If you cast from some variable and that is filled somehow, I don't care how, if you then try to do something like that, you get the casting expression. So I'm kind of hurrying through the through these things now, for providing class structure and programming a main function, you need a little bit more. But the essential things are these.
Are the ancestors the same class? So could it be a diamond, or are they different, like you've drawn there?
If you would have. that is this way of signifying of what I would actually want to have. I think if I would be strictly just trying to put that into this UML thing, I would have to join them probably. I'm not so much of a UML expert here. I think that what I do here is kind of weird with having two symbols represent the same. So that is already kind of hinting at that there is the version without virtual inheritance meant here. So I think the UML programmer would kind of use something like that. And if you wanted to have virtual inheritance, you would put this virtual as a keyword on there.
So A is... the same for both for M and F.
In the it had reasons why I put it that way. So it's the non-virtual thing. With the virtual thing, you don't get the ambiguous casting type thing, but it would say that the static cast can't be applied here. It's another a different reason why the thing fails. Yeah, it's. I think it's quite the lesson to learn what you actually buy yourself into when you apply all these things like the virtual calls and the multiple inheritance and even doing that at the same time. there's a lot of extra work going on behind the scenes with all this casting and with all the lookups that you have to perform. And imagine that if you, for example, access the attributes of your virtual base class, you always perform indirection memory. It's not that you directly call a certain thing, but you always have to go through this virtual base pointer thing and apply the offset where you find your attribute to this computed address. Of course, within the same method, you might have an optimizing compiler that then reuses this computed address. But still, there's a lot of things going on there, which you wouldn't expect if you translate your or if you are used to your attributes being just there in memory and having constant addresses. So, yeah, that's overhead that you have to pay. Okay. So now the larger scale topics. This is a more elaborate example here of a C++ class hierarchy with a lot of things going on there. There's attributes found in the classes, there's virtual inheritance, there's standard inheritance, there's multiple inheritance in there. And what I haven't shown you so far in the lecture is what you can actually obtain as your virtual table through compiler interfaces. I think that's still the... I can't remember whether that is still the ugly version of that or the newer version. I think there's also a little bit more modernized view on the virtual table out there, which clearly marks you what what these things actually are, because I think in here I have removed that either, or that is an older excerpt from the compiler. Either way, what's that all about? It's all about drawing the layout for a class D object memory representation, and the virtual table is something that is given to you, so you don't have to care about placing things like vcall offsets or deciding on how to reuse your virtual tables and all that. But you can concentrate on just doing the design of the object representation for that thing here. So, that's the complete overview. So we need to design an object representation for this D thing, the D class. And we might find A, B, C representations in there, because it's a composition of representations. So I hope that I can fit it somehow on there. Good. So, how do I lay out my object on there? We have to think in a kind of a modular way. So, although it works to start from the specialized class D, I think it might be more approachable to start with the basic blocks like class A and class B and all that. So for designing D, we need to think about how to design C and B. For C, we need to think about how to have A, and for B, we need to think about how A is represented anyway. So if I would like to have an A separately, I would have something like labeled with A. And for A, we need a virtual table because virtual is already there. So the first entry in A will all the time be a virtual table pointer. And also, A will carry an integer. So that will always happen for A. So we don't find any entries for F or G in there. It's just always F. And yeah, I think that's it. Okay, then A and B, if I put them together in the manner that we see here, then what's going to happen? I will get an extension of B. It's just standard singular inheritance. There's no multiple inheritance here, so I can extend it over here. I don't need to replicate the vtable pointer. I can just reuse the one that I already have. But what I definitely need to do is I need to create memory space for B. So that is the B. That is the A representation. If I do C a C representation here, yeah, there I get a virtual inheritance of A. So, in principle, we only have a single parent. So we tend to just repeat the same thing as we have done before. However, keeping in mind that we have these possibly situations where we have different contexts, where my base, virtual base, might somehow shift in memory to some other space, I need to take care that I will find the correct position of my virtual base in relation to my own object. So, although in principle, with just the situation in here, we only have one parent, I need to somehow do something about addressing. And this will turn out to lay out my object set in a way that I don't share my virtual table pointer anymore, but instead I have to do my own. So in that case, I will, yeah, let's maybe, I'm running out of space here, excuse me for doing that. I have my A representation here with the V pointer and the int A. And I have my parent C. This, we said that the virtual base would go to the top, to the bottom of my memory space, such that in a way that I have space for my virtual child over at the top, and I can put C in there. Because we have this this situation of position of the virtual base in a non-constant way, I can't directly share the virtual pointer. So C has its own V pointer and carries it its own in C. We don't have to replicate A because we know that we inherit the A attribute from a virtual base class and address indirectly through the virtual base pointer anyway. So that's something we don't have to replicate, but we need to make sure that we have a V pointer. Good. So finally, we can now think about how to set up the memory for D. D is now working on the components for C and D. So C is its first parent, D is the second, B is the second parent. So C goes first, then B in memory, then comes D. And we will see how to distribute the A fractions of the classes anyway. So how does that look like? The C representation comes first. So the first part in here is the one that carries C with its V pointer and its int C. Then, in principle, we would have the A part of the whole thing. However, that is a virtual base, and we have learned virtual bases always go to the bottom. If you have several of them, which are not with the same name, then, well, I don't know how you would arrange them, but it doesn't matter because it's a dynamic offset anyway. So they just go somehow to the bottom, and the concrete layout, we don't even care. You can do what you want there. But in any way, what we need to do there is we need to place it at the bottom. So we get an A representation here with its own V pointer and int A. Yeah, then in order to continue with the D, we need to, we have finished with C, so that thing we have. Now we have to concentrate on bringing B into the game. B is layouted the way that we've seen over there. It's an extension to an A. And with this direct non-virtual inheritance that is here, the whole thing is kind of a building block. We can't put the A part out of this thing, and we even don't want to. Semantics says that our B object always has its own reference to an A. So for that, we have then this B in there, which in itself carries its own private A. So there's an A part with a V pointer and an int A and the B part like that. And they still do their sharing thing. Remember, the B is the second parent, so it can't share with, well, it shares with its own inner parent, the virtual pointer, but not with the one in which it is the second partner. This is the second parent. Yeah, it's quite a complicated diagram there. Then, with that, we have both partners, both parents, C and B, done. Or we can continue with D. So that is the D part now, and this one has an int D, and we should probably check for whether we need to have an own V pointer. Do we need to? No, it's a child of multiple inheritance, and it can share its V pointer with its first parent, which would be the red V pointer. That's how you do the layout. Yeah. The next thing, I don't dare to move the fragment of screen that you see here, because that would remove my representation. I want to complete it. But I can read out what the next task would be. Maybe let's also get rid of these intermediary things, because they obstruct the view on the underlying stuff. So, for each V pointer attribute in your drawing, give the entry number to which V table entry this pointer is pointing. Yeah. So, for something like that, we would probably think a little bit about how many V pointers actually are there, but we have already done so when composing our things. So let's talk about that. Then also let's maybe think about what are potential entry points into the V table anyway. And for that, let's maybe look at here. You see there's this these RTTI things. There's VBase to offset, offset to top, offset to top, function pointers, VCall offsets. So the question is, which of those are actual candidates for entry points into the virtual table? If you think back to the slides, we've said that entry points are always assumed to be function pointers. So that removes already a lot of the lines over here. Also, we've said that we would have an index running down. So above the function pointers, we always find this RTTI space. So yeah, we have one RTTI thing followed by a function pointer. So that might be a valid entry point. That might be a valid entry point, and that might be a valid entry point. Good. That is quite the lucky thing, because we have three different V table pointers in our object representation. Wonder why. So we somehow have to associate them with each other. Let's have a look at what else is there to give you clues about which might belong to which. So we see that there's things called this recall offsets in there, which are directly above offset to top entries. The only still tutorial.
You
könnt schon essen gehen, also wir machen noch Tutorial. So the only place where we have seen something like V-calls, remember that, was during the thing with a virtual basis, and V-call entries were several that were found on top of that thing. So if you see something like that, that is already an indicator for that's the virtual base table for the the virtual table for the virtual base pointer. So number 13 is probably assumed to be in there. Good. Then the others. They are organized like this, where we have the is it? Okay. So we have candidates 3 and 6 still available for vpointers of C and of A. And the question is now, which is which? I, for myself, I'm a little bit confused here, I must say. Because I would have expected it to look a little bit differently. Do you see what I mean from not telling? especially the thing that irritates me right now is that we have a starting point with one function f and one with f, g, and h, while we have one function, one virtual table that should do for the composition of A and B, where we would see the functions f, h, and inherited from A, g, that would probably be number 6, I would say. And we have a function pointer in the object C, which of course sees f, so there's an f here. But I would say that it probably also needs an entry for g. I think it doesn't make sense the way that it is like here, so I have to check whether I added a few methods afterwards in my sources, so that might throw the whole thing a little bit off. What I would have meant to have is 3 here, but I think I've done some modifications afterwards and didn't synchronize with the content of the virtual table. So I would say in principle there should have been a G entry in there. Doesn't make sense the way that it is here. But what we can say for sure is that the recalls are indicating for line 13 to be the one associated with the virtual base, which has F and G, by the way. So it somehow is present here, but might be that the G was added afterwards and didn't make it up here. And the one where we see F, G, and H must be the one where H is introduced, which is B. So that's how you can differentiate them. Anyway, yeah, I fear I have to patch this thing a little bit and maybe check whether that was correct, but I guess so. So apart from that, the next one. D's virtual table is composed of several subtables. Your object memory representation is also composed of several parts, corresponding to particular subclasses. For each subclass, part of your memory representation, give the entry numbers where the corresponding subtable within these virtual tables starts and ends. So it is about drawing kind of lines into the virtual table where we separate our conceptual view of each table to each other. So let's maybe start with what D's virtual table actually is like. I don't work with line numbers here, but I can just draw boxes there, so that should be the thing to go here for. So D's virtual table, of course, is kind of the whole deal. It's kind of this one. So that, because that is the whole virtual table here. So the one for the A from under here for this one here. Well, it needs to have the V calls in there, it needs to have an offset to top, and it needs to have its own function table. So for that, we should probably start with the V call offsets and end with the last of these functions. So that would be that part. Then we have the red part, which is for the C virtual table. And yeah, we have discussed about the fact that I would assume that there should also be another one in there. I have to recheck that, but you get an updated version of the tutorial sheet as the solution then, and you can look it up then. But I guess there should be another G in there. But in principle, what you have is this virtual base offset, the offset to top, and all the functions that C is able to see. So the next one then would be the B part. So the which, no, not red, green I wanted. The part for this. That would be the part that starts with offset to top, has an RTTI, and then all the functions in scope. That should be this part. And then inside there, there is another not blue, sorry. In principle, it's also blue, but to differentiate from the other blue thing, I draw a yellow thing in there, which makes it even greener. But yeah, so this A part in here is not the same virtual table part as the one for the virtual base pointer, although it is the same class conceptually. So this is the notion where we see that there's shared parts of the virtual table, which are reflecting the extension that we also do on the object representation. And that means that everything that is visible from A, which is F and G, should be in there together with the offset to top, but we don't see the H in there. Well, we would if we would use an index large enough, but that A doesn't know about that and thus can't generate an access to that because there's just no concept of where to find something like H. So that would be the line numbers that you would need to use for the things in there. It's a little bit hidden in there because, yeah, you see there's two representations of A in there, so I can't write for each class name the range of virtual tables that is associated with that part. I need to refer to the representations in memory because there you can decide between which of the areas in the virtual table is associated with those things. Good. So the last thing, that's where I also did some manual work on the virtual table, which probably messed up my entries in there. Thunks were not highlighted in the virtual table. Compare the entries 3, 6, and 13, which are already marked with yellow in my drawing here, and decide which of them are thunks, which are virtual thunks, and which are direct addresses of function F from D. Yeah, so which is which?
I would say 3 is a direct address because D shares the virtual pointer with C. So the virtual pointer pointing to 3 is the virtual pointer of D, so it has to be a direct address.
That's completely correct. So the flipping egg each time. No, even more fun. Okay. So this one here, the one from 3, is the direct implementation. There's no address manipulation needed to reach the vtable entry. Thus, it doesn't need any thunking. Yeah. Then we have the candidates from 6 and 13. We know now that they are thunks. We just don't know which of them is the virtual one. But yeah, it's not so difficult anymore since we have already marked the things that make up what that should act as. So the part in the green virtual table is from the inner fraction of the parents of D and is not virtually inherited. So for number 6, we know there is address manipulation necessary to reach that vtable pointer, but it is not a dynamic value. You don't have to look it up, so that is an ordinary thunk. That leaves us with this one here, and that is part of the vtable that is there for the virtual base. Virtual base is arranged in a way that you can't reach it through a compile time constant address offset, thus this must be the virtual thunk.
Okay. I think with that you have quite intensive example for how to come up with layouts for class and object structures. Is there still any questions on how to create these memory representations, how to do sharing, how to arrange them? No? These must be darn good tutorial examples here, if you're always that speechless afterwards. Okay. By the way, that exercise went particularly bad in the exam 2014. That's maybe why I put it on here, to give you kind of a training. Yeah, I never dared to do something like that from that point on, but now we have had it as an exercise. That's maybe good. Okay, so that was the version that I did then in 2016, daring a new start with multiple inheritance in an exam question. And I thought maybe all these theoretical drawings would be kind of off-putting for you. So I instead devised a kind of more programming-oriented exercise. It went a little bit better in the exam, but still, that might have been a little bit strange to you. It was more of the idea of trying to give a runtime idea of how to combine the runtime and the compile time, in the sense of what you need to provide for that in order to work together. So I think it's an interpreter for C++ classes written in a Java-like language. So the idea is to have a situation like this one here, where the C++ code over here, which would be classically one multiple inheritance, which we will see afterwards a little bit, and method calls that are somehow working on a upcasted version of the object, and I think it's also virtual method calls all the time. So that is a fraction of code, and there's a static
scheme of how to compile that into calls to a runtime system. So the right part over here is what the left part is translated to. And it's the purpose of the implementations of the methods on the right that should semantically arrange everything such that the original behavior is still intact, in the sense that the programmer wanted the class structure to work in a certain way. That's how the left part looked like. And with the implementations of the things that we find on the right-hand side, we want to implement that behavior with the classes that we get given as already implemented, and or at least the interfaces, I think. The signatures of the Java classes or interfaces used in this generated code can be found in the appendix. So there's an appendix also present here. That is this one here. That gives us implementations of methods that are used within the translated part, within the interpreter. Or in case that there's no implementations, you find interfaces on which you can rely, and even descriptions on what certain parts of these implementations should do. So, what do we get here? We get a notion of how a type is implemented in our interpreter. It's always an interface that has a thing that parses you the type representing object from a string representation found somewhere, maybe in cast expressions or whatever. You can create such a type from that. So that's kind of your constructor for such a thing. Then you get call virtual, which would serve for performing the actual virtual method call to method M on a receiver pointer P with the parameters like that. There's no implementation for given that, it's just an interface specification that already smells like something that you might have to do yourself later on. There's a thing that casts pointers. Remember, that is also one of the actions which behaves depending on what type you actually are in. So that starts with a certain pointer, gives you a casting target as a string, maybe originating from some kind of cast operator, and puts out another pointer. Think about what can happen in multiple inheritance. There might be casts that do nothing, just give back the parameter. There might be casts that adjust something in there, so they need to do something. So that is also something which is highly dependent on the actual type, so there's no implementation given here. Also smells like something that you might have to implement. Then there's a get constructor. That's something that might need to be... That doesn't matter too much right now. That's something that generates such a type. Then you can query the type for its size. You don't have to care about the size by yourself. You can just query it with a get size. It's given as an implementation here. You don't have to care about how to compute these things. The only thing that you need to know is how to get these sizes is, well, you have to call them on the right types. So you somehow need to create such a type. So maybe something like that to create the type beforehand would be a good idea, and then you can get its size from the method over there, because that gives you a type and that lets you query the type for a size. So that is kind of the interface for that. Then what is a pointer and what is a method? Pointer is something which you can malloc, so you have an interface to your memory allocation facilities. You don't have to care about that yourself. That's given for you. You also don't have to care about adding or subtracting yourself. It's just given. The only thing that you need is you need to provide an offset. So that is of type int. There is a size of type int that should already give you certain clues about how to collaborate with them. You might also have to go along a pointer and obtain whatever is stored in there as a direct object, and with that, yeah, you need somehow a dereferencing method for that. Then there's methods, and methods are things that you can directly call. So that is always when you would directly write a constant name of a function there, you could use this call direct thing. If you need to do some kind of indirect calls, you would have to do this dereferencing and call direct yourself, so to say. So the only thing that we have is this type method, which we can cast to and then do a call direct. So that's the only facility that we are given. So in order to do an indirect call, we need to do everything yourself in the sense of dereferencing, and then the resulting thing should have a call direct thing. With that, you can somehow access function pointers from somewhere, to, dereference them and call them directly in case you want to navigate through several layers of indirection. So that is the facilities that you get. That's somehow just the basic mechanics that we had in this LLVM, just translated to what an interpreter written in Java would actually offer in terms of runtime things. And now we can toy around with that, especially in the context of that sequence here. You see how the interpreter is used in the right part of the whole thing here. So that's the code that will be executed all the time, but just on different class environments. So you see there's this the part that I've mentioned already several times. There is the concept of obtaining a type from a string, and then we can use it as a Java class. Then there's a concept of pointers, but pointers don't just live arbitrarily out there. You need to allocate memory for them, and you need to provide them with certain size. So the pointer to C, PC, is created from a malloc that is called on the pointer, so that's our interface to the memory management system, and we obtain size of C amount of memory. That's directly what that thing does. And we needed to construct this C thing in order to represent type, in order to get the size for that. Then there's this odd part of having something like a constructor in there, this thing here. So that's what I'm not so much interested in, but for correctness purposes, that's something that has to happen here. So there's this get constructor for a type. It's always the same thing here, and it can be called directly in the constructor. Doesn't have any parameters apart from, of course, the receiver, which is itself. That's this PC thing. So all that is needed to represent the first line. Oh, very nice. Okay. Shut up.
So, next instruction is this cast thing, which is represented with this one, and you see all that happens here is the complete action is happening in the cast pointer to thing that we got specified as an interface from our API, but never have seen a implementation of that. What's happening here is that the pointer PC is casted to this A thing. And we came from a type of C, which was the right-hand side thing. So that's what's happening here. There might be stuff necessary to do, depending on how C actually looks like. We don't know yet. We haven't only seen that part. In the end, then, we get an indirect call. What we see is here this call virtual. We also have seen that there is no implementation given for that, and that might be a task for you later on. So that's the general setting. And now we get several contexts on that should talk about how these of these classes C and A and all that work together. So there's the first context, which is this ABC class structure, where we just have a linear inheritance relation. There's no multiple inheritance involved whatsoever. And the question is now to draw a memory representation diagram for C object and a virtual table diagram for class C. We already had a tutorial on how to do that last exercise. So also our time has probably run out quite a lot right now. That's a thing that I will probably skip, but that would have been a place where to insert that in such an exercise. Then the actual interesting part is now give implementations for cast pointer 2 and call virtual for the type corresponding to C from directly above. So now with the context that we see here, we should specify how cast pointer 2 and call virtual need to work. Considering that there's no virtual inheritance here, and then there's no multiple inheritance here either, cast pointer in that setting will probably never do anything else than just give its parameter back. So that's the easy point here. And the call virtual will just navigate to through the virtual table.
But if you call cast a C to a B, you have to add something to the
point. C to an A in this case, but
no, C to B.
C to B. We would have if B would be an inner parent of multiple inheritance. Remember, we have this C representation.
Oh, because B expects A to be there. Because B.
Exactly, it's just extensions from each other. So that is the easy part of the complete thing. So there's nothing complicated going on. We don't have any cast things. We don't need necessarily any thunks or whatever. It's just plain dereferencing of the virtual table and nothing more. That was meant as kind of the easy route through that exam question, being able to answer 1 and 2. But of course, that needs you to realize that that is the easy setting. Yeah, and then there's the kind of augmented version of the same setting, where we then do the stuff that you have already indicated. Here we find that there is parents B and A involved. And
to throw you off a little bit from the designs that you have seen in the lecture, I have just switched around the role of A and B. So this time A is the inner parent, thus casting to A is the cast that actually has action necessary. So when implementing this cast pointer 2, you have to actually do something for cast pointer 2. You have to obtain the size of B and add it to your this pointer, to your receiver pointer, and then do a direct call on the method that you would actually want to call. And I think that is the only part which was a little bit difficult in there, how to actually obtain such a thing. And yeah, I think that was graded as extra points if you got that right, and if you didn't get that right, then it was okay. Yeah. Anyway, it was difficult enough with just realizing that cast pointer 2 needs to do something here and nothing thing before. The last one is one of the above virtual tables has a thunk implementation for F. Which one? Yeah, well, I think we have ridden on this bicycle for long enough now. What do you need for a thunk implementation? You need multiple inheritance somehow, or even virtual base classes. Which of the examples has that? Yeah, the easy one doesn't have it. There is no multiple inheritance, so we can only choose three. So that's this one. Provide an implementation of the interface method call that performs necessary actions in our frame. Ah, that's this bonus thing here. So that's a little bit fiddly, and I think you can't directly do that. And that was the bonus thing, if you have time enough, because I think that was the very last question on the complete sheet. So yeah. Okay, that's it. I didn't have the time to actually show you the real code, but you will find it in the solution. And turns out that it's kind of three liners each, so it's not too much to do. And that is also kind of one of the principles for these written exam things. I try to keep programming, although it might be in there, I don't want to stress too much in the sense of writing page-wise code for whatever you want to implement. Okay, with that, I think I'm done for today.